You're listening to the Busy Creator Podcast, episode 67, with guest Mignon Fogarty. Hello and welcome to the Busy Creator Podcast from BusyCreator.com. This is the show for creative pros who want to be more effective and less stressed, do their best work, and be their most creative, productive selves. I'm your host, Prescott Perez Fox. This is episode 67 of the Busy Creator Podcast, and today I'm speaking with Mignon Fogarty, who is better known as Grammar Girl. If you're not familiar, Grammar Girl is a long-running podcast that discusses the English language and offers quick and dirty tips to improve your writing. It's one of my faves, has been one of my faves. I've been listening for the show for almost like 9 years when it started, and I actually met Mignon Fogarty back in 2007 or so at a podcaster meetup in New York, but never really got to hear the story of how she operates her empire and how she puts together the show each week. And so that's what we cover today. There's also some great insight for anyone who works in publishing, whether it's a blog, a podcast, a YouTube channel, or something else. And I think that any of us who are workaday creative pros should pay close attention to the entrepreneurial moves that Mignon has made and how she managed to escape her role as a technical writer and really build this very successful network. The show notes for this episode will be available online at busycreator.com/67 for episode 67. And that's where we'll have all the links, book recommendations, quotations, and contact details. So one quick note before we jump in, there is a wee audio glitch at about 10 minutes into the conversation, and I actually chose to leave it in because, first of all, I have no idea how it got there, and believe it or not, it's actually a little funny, so I enjoy that. I hope you will too. Okay, let's get right into the conversation with Mignon Fogarty. I spoke to her via Skype from her home office in Reno, Nevada. Or Nevada, whatever. Hey, Mignon, how are you?
Hey, good. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, definitely. I've been trying to get you on for several months, but I know that you were preoccupied in your new role as a professor, so I should call you professor now.
That's right, and I'm a busy creator.
Oh, yes, indeed. Creating minds. So actually, I have a question right off the top. This is totally like a little gimme. Why do you think, or in your research, do the British put the emphasis on the title professor, whereas the Americans like to put doctor when that's available?
Oh my gosh, that's a great question, and I have no idea.
I've always been puzzled by that.
It is really interesting, though. I mean, at the I'm a professor at the University of Nevada in Reno. So we're out west, you know, in the wild, independent land. Everyone just has the students call them by their first name. So my students just call me Mignon.
Oh.
And they don't call me Professor Fogarty. I mean, some of them do because they want to, but in general, everyone calls the professors by their first name. So it's really informal. I noticed that when I go back east on the East Coast, professors there are much more likely to refer to each other as Professor So-and-so. So there's even a difference within this country, I think, between the East Coast, which tends to be more formal, and the West Coast, which tends to be more informal.
Okay, yeah, definitely that West Coast surfer vibe, perhaps. That's always funny to me about the British professor thing, because I'm thinking of Dr. Alice Roberts, who is a TV personality as well as I think she is a medical doctor, but she teaches anthropology and anatomy. But her Twitter handle is Dr. Alice Roberts, but the name that she uses on Twitter is Professor Alice Roberts.
Right, and you can be a professor without being a doctor, too. So I only have a master's, so I'm not a doctor. And then, I don't know how it is in Britain, but in America, then there's the confusion. If you say you're a doctor, people think you're a medical doctor. And yeah, I think professor is safer in that sense. There's no confusion.
Yeah, that's just a funny observation. Anyway, professor. So this isn't usually a biography show. I like to say this is a show that's about the how rather than the total what that you've done. But I definitely want to hear a little bit about your story, about the story of Grammar Girl and the story of Quick and Dirty Now. It's especially compelling because a lot of the listeners of this show, creative pros who are sort of workaday creatives, and they're trying or thinking about or planning or scheming to do a content network, to do publishing, and to really take that into another area of business, which you've done really over the last 10 years. So can you just take us through briefly about Grammar Girl, the blog, I guess the persona of Grammar Girl, and then the podcast, which is how I came to know you.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of power in networks. So you can do a lot of cross promotion and support each other. So I've always believed in building networks. So I started Grammar Girl, the podcast, that came first. And I started it as essentially a hobby. I was working as a technical writer and editor, and I saw my clients making the same mistakes over and over again. And I love technology. So I heard about this new thing called podcasting, and I wanted to give it a try. This was 10 years ago. I started the Grammar Girl podcast, and much to my surprise, it took off almost immediately. Within 6 weeks, it was number 2 at iTunes. So this hobby that I had come up with was suddenly something that I recognized could be a business and could be a platform that I could use to launch a network. So pretty soon after Grammar Girl took off, within a month or two, I started asking my friends if they wanted to do podcasts too. So all the early Quick and Dirty Tips podcasters, that's what I called the network, Quick and Dirty Tips, were my friends who I had special skills in different areas. Modern Manners Guy was just, you know, really good at manners, and The Mighty Mommy was a great mom, and Money Girl was my neighbor who was really good with money. And, you know, we built this network of, I think it was 5 or 6 shows, and they all did quite well because they had the boost of launching. You know, I could announce that they were launching in the Grammar Girl podcast, just like people do today with newer networks, and they did really well right out of the gate. Eventually, the Wall Street Journal picked Grammar Girl as the web pick of the day, and at that point, I got the attention of a bunch of big New York publishers. And I already realized that I couldn't do it all myself, and so I was looking, actively looking for a partner. And it turned out that Macmillan Publishing was looking to launch a digital initiative. They wanted to get more into the digital world. It was a great fit. I needed help. They wanted to do something digital. So we partnered up and grew the Quick and Dirty Tips podcast network, which they now do the day-to-day operations. We grew that to 14 or 15 shows, it is today.
Wow. And did you feel always from the beginning that podcasting was sort of a more natural mechanism to get the word out rather than a blog alone?
I just really love it. I was working with one of my graduate students on a different podcast the other day and just remembered how much I love the act of putting together a podcast. You know, I just love editing audio. I just really enjoy the process.
Sure.
So, you know, enjoyed that from the beginning and always wanted to keep doing it. Because Grammar Girl is scripted, right? It's a show about grammar, and nobody speaks perfectly off the cuff.
Yeah.
So it really needs to be scripted. But then that script is a blog post. It's really easy to put the script up on the website. So I just always did that from the beginning, just because I had it.
I
may as well post it. It turns out that's really great for search engine optimization and helped people find me in a whole different way from the podcast. So the podcast and the blog really work together to create, you know, a successful business with multiple lines of revenue.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking actually about your show, how, you know, it's the script, but it's essentially a transcript, so you can refer back to it. So there was a post on Reddit just a few days ago, actually, I think you'll enjoy this, that someone asked in the Explain It Like I'm 5 category, why do some people have last names like green and black and silver and white, but they don't have names like yellow and blue and orange? And I was like, oh, that's, you know, they started talking about blacksmith and whitesmith, how it's like the professions get shortened and everything. And then that, of course, turned into a question about the word orange in English and how Grammar Girl had sort of unraveled that one just a few weeks ago, at least by my memory. And I was like, I know exactly where to go to find the answer to this question. Sent them to the blog post, and then all the people below were like, oh my God, I never knew that orange-haired people were called redheads, etc. So that was, yeah, there's a funny way that you could just, you have this, you listen to it once, but then you know that the blog is there and you can refer back to it. You have this memory of your archive, which I'm actually finding in my own show as well, having only done it for 18 months.
Right. I mean, I've done it for 9 years. So if you have a question, there's usually a podcast that will answer that question. It's kind of surprising when someone asks me a question and there isn't a show about it, and I make a note and, you know, to do it later. But yeah, I loved that Orange Head episode. That was written by Gretchen McCulloch, who is a linguistics PhD.
Uh-huh.
And that's one thing that I've done a lot more in the last few years is I brought, again, because you just can't do everything yourself, I brought in a bunch of guest writers, particularly for the kind of linguistics questions that I can't answer because I don't have that training. I wouldn't know how to answer why still we call redheads redheads and not orange heads.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gretchen, because of her linguistics background, actually knows the answer to that question. So I find it fascinating for me to learn the answers and really helpful to have, you know, a handful of guest writers that I can turn to help answer questions that either I don't know the answer to, or maybe I don't have the time to do a show every single week now all by myself.
Sure. So that actually leads me to another question, where there's a lot of talk these days about the kind of solo practitioner as entrepreneur, and how some people, their first thought is, okay, so in this case, you got a popular podcast, a popular blog. Some people's first thought will be, okay, now I got to hire a bunch of people to help me create the content so I can be the figurehead. But other people will say, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to do it. It's my solo work, and I want to just do this craft. Did you naturally become this entrepreneur? Did you always have that tendency where you sort of foresaw the larger vision of an entire network and the people involved?
Yes and no. I mean, I always saw the vision of the network. I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. And when I was in college, my roommate and I made and sold hair accessories to help pay our way through college. She's a venture capitalist now.
Oh, wow. So, and that was well before Etsy, too.
Way before. Yeah, way before Etsy. So, you know, I've been an entrepreneur for many, many years. I do find it hard to delegate. I always prefer to do things myself, but you just can't. Right, you just have to find people you can trust if you want to grow. Like if I wanted to do nothing but produce the podcast every week, sure, I could do that by myself. But I have large social media accounts to maintain. You know, people email me, people approach me with business opportunities all the time. Like I can't handle everything yeah. that comes at me like that. And so, yeah, there was a time McMillan running Quick and Dirty Tips has sort of slid down the path over time. So in the beginning, the first couple of years, I still did a lot of the day-to-day operations. I edited everyone's scripts for all the other Quick and Dirty Tips shows. I was still the editor. And then I just couldn't do it all. And so we came to the agreement, you know, they took over a little more of the company and they took over managing all the other shows. And I just focused on being Grammar Girl. You know, and I did that sort of by myself for a couple of years. And then even that became too much. And first I hired a part-time assistant to help me answer the email and to manage some of the social media. I still respond to everything myself, but she picked the posts that go up and helps me sort of keep that pipeline moving. You know, and then just in the last year, really, I've always had guest writers, but in the last year, since I started the professor position, I've had to rely more on guest writers. And I do miss writing the show. I mean, that always was my favorite part, is creating the show. And I don't do that as much anymore. But it's the only way it can keep going with everything else I'm doing, too.
Sure. And you always give credit, of course, which is great.
Yeah.
But I sort of miss the, I guess, your signature mark, which was that you use examples including aardvark and squiggly.
I know. And I do still edit the shows. And sometimes I remember to change the example sentences and put those in. But yeah, no, squiggly and aardvark have been missing this past year more than usual. And I miss them too.
No, that's all good. Because I like those, I guess you could almost call them long form, right? That they're, when the show started, I think it was like 5 minutes, if I remember correctly. And it was like you said, it was like an audio blog post and it was scripted. And that was totally fine, because most podcasts were, as they still are, these kind of 40-minute roundtable discussions, and that's great too. But there wasn't a lot of those quick and dirty sort of podcasts. But now it's like you could have an episode that's like 20 minutes, but it's this history of a linguistic phrase or grammar usage, American versus Australian, that type of thing. So I really like digging into the longer episodes. So it's not necessarily better or worse. It's just a sort of evolution as time has passed, which is cool.
Thanks. I like them too. I like the longer show. It keeps me more interested to do those more complicated topics. And I had started doing more complicated topics, and then I felt like I was getting away from the whole quick and dirty tips idea.
Yeah.
So now the show has three segments, and the first segment is always a quick and dirty tip. And then the middle segment is always something longer and more interesting. The only thing that's bad is I decided to make the show three times as long at the same time I was starting a new full-time job.
Right.
So, you know, I look back sometimes and think, what was I thinking? But overall, I'm really happy with the new format. So I'm glad to hear you like it too.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go right into that, because we love talking about process and workflow on this program. So how does an episode come together, not just of Grammar Girl, but I suppose if there's differences in all the other shows, that'd be great to highlight. But let's start with Grammar Girl. Like, how does an episode come together?
these days, so I will look for a quick and dirty tip, and usually that's the first segment, and that usually exists already somewhere, whether it's a newsletter tip. I also have an email newsletter, and a lot of those tips have never gone out in the podcast. Or I have four books, a series of four books that are called 101 something or other, so 101 misused words, 101 troublesome words, and those are all also really short tips. And like the newsletter, those tips were always too short to include in the podcast. Well, now that I have three segments, I can include those short tips. So the first part is finding the quick and dirty tip, which usually just means finding a relevant existing tip that's in the newsletter or the books or something like that. The meaty middle, the longer segment that is often about a linguistics topic, if I haven't written it myself, usually I'm not these days, I have a few linguists who write for me, and they will pitch me ideas, or I will have ideas based on questions that listeners have asked. And so example, I'll say like, hey, I have an idea for a show. Do you think this is interesting? Do you think you could do a whole show about it? You know, sometimes.
So is that very formal? Is there like a Monday morning meeting where television? Okay.
No, in fact, it's all by email. I think I have a guest writer or two that I've never actually spoken to. We just do everything by email. I'm very much an email person. So if I can get out of calling someone, I will. Yeah. So we do it all by email, and I let them pick their deadlines. You know, they all have other jobs and responsibilities. So I say, you know, I'm interested in this. Do you want to write it? When can you give it to me? Usually they say yes. Sometimes they'll suggest a revision. They'll give me a date and I'll send it. That's how that meaty middle works. And I'm right now, I've been trying to get ahead over the summer because teaching is hard during the year to try to do everything. So I have shows scheduled out about 6 or 7 weeks right now. I don't have them all received, but everything is assigned.
Okay.
For the next 6 or 7 weeks. And then the final segment of the show is a tidbit, which tends to be something about an idiom. You know, why do we call something a hat trick? Something like that. And then...
We were talking about this over the weekend. I was at a wedding and we were talking about origins of phrases and how so many of them come from trains. And
really?
my friend was like, what do you mean so many come from trains? And I just rattled them off. I was like, okay, all the bells and whistles, whistle stop tour, firing on all cylinders, sidetracked, off track, all those other ones, a train of thought. Like, I don't know where I picked those up over the years, but...
Yeah, that's super true. And there's so many. And so one, the origin is fascinating. And also, Grammar Girl is pretty popular overseas. And so people who are learning English also often don't understand what these idioms mean. And so it's helpful to those listeners to have the word origin tidbit. And then it's just fascinating. Like fast and loose comes from an old carnival game that people used to play with a rope, and you had to hold it fast and loose, but there was no way to do it right, so you'd always lose. They're just really interesting. Like the saxophone was named after Adolf Sax. There's like a Mr. Sax.
right.
You know, things like that I just find fascinating. And again, they're not so much grammar, but they're language tidbits. And so we call that segment the tidbit. So you've got the quick and dirty tip, the meaty middle, and the tidbit.
And then I suppose once it's written by one of your little helper elves.
Right. So they submit the scripts to me.
Yep.
And then I make sure that they go together. You know, usually they do, but sometimes maybe I'll be like, oh, this tidbit goes better with that script. So I might move things around. Or often we'll like crash something in that's related to the news. We had the origin of tall poppy syndrome a few weeks ago because an actress tweeted about people with tall poppy syndrome attacking her. It's an Australian phrase that means like lopping off the head of the poppy that's taller than all the rest.
Uh-huh.
So it means it relates to beating down someone who's rising up
out of line, right?
Above anyone else. Like, oh, you think you're cool? Here, let's lop you down to size. So, but because the celebrity tweeted it, we wanted to get that out right away. So like we crashed that into the schedule. So we do that a lot with things that are timely. So that always mixes things up.
Sure.
But then, you know, so then I have the three segments and I write the introduction and I write the ads that go in the show. You know, we have ads, so I have to weave that into the script and I get it all together. If we have any announcements, I put them in the end. And then I have the script and, you know, I might edit it a little bit. The only thing I usually do is edit it for audio. Sometimes guest writers, especially new guest writers, might not think about how something sounds when you say it as opposed to how it reads.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I've experienced this too, writing my own scripts, which is a whole other kind of weird look in the mirror that certain words look fine when they're printed next to each other. But if you try to say the two of them together, you end up tripping over yourself or it turns into, you know, some kind of a malapropism or something like that, where you...
Right. Like, I cannot, like, it's so hard to say contexts, like, multiple...
Right.
Yeah, I just can't say contexts. So I was
right.
Just something else. Yeah, and then I record it. I still often record at home in my walk-in closet using my Snowball mic. But now, because wow. I'm on campus in the School of Journalism, I do have access to a professional radio studio. So I can record
nice.
There if I want to, although I don't hear a huge difference in the audio.
Okay. Well, it sounds great either way, which is interesting always to hear about the sort of DIY setup.
Yeah, and so I record the show, and then Macmillan employs a freelance producer who takes it from there and puts in the music, edits out the pops, I usually edit out my own misspeaks unless I get my show done really, really early. So I try to send it to my producer as clean as I can. But if I don't, he'll fix anything I miss. And then he drops it in the feed and makes the associated web post on the site live. And yeah, because there's a whole background thing actually where also I'm uploading the scripts to the website, you know, each segment of the script becomes its own page on the website.
Sure.
And yeah, I used to do that myself, and now my assistant helps me with that. Again, if I get it done early enough. Lately, we've been spending more time creating images to go with the articles. So we're trying
yeah.
to sort of boost our Pinterest traffic. So we're spending more time creating custom images that go
Absolutely.
With each article. So,
yeah, I just went to a conference and they were talking about that in one of the sessions, using Pinterest to promote a podcast. And you know, your first thought, you'd say, well, hang on, this is audio. What does it have to do with visual, especially the kind of rich photographic visual that you sometimes have to trip over yourself? And we were talking about that. But I'm curious if you're doing all that. I mean, you just mentioned, you know, four or five different people and different locations and everything. And you're doing it all on email. Have you explored a workflow tool like Trello or Freedcamp, which we just had the founder of Freedcamp on this show a few weeks ago?
Yeah, it's really interesting. For my social media class last spring, we used Trello. And I know that's been serving some of my students and got jobs after, and where they work, they're using Trello. So it was great that they used that. And I intend to use Slack with my graduate students this fall. But so far at Quick and Dirty Tips, the way we do it has been working well for us. So I don't think anyone is eager to change. Although, I mean, maybe after I try Slack, I'll lobby for change. But right now, email seems to be working just fine.
Sure. Hey, don't change it if it's working. I'm just curious because I'm a big geek for that stuff. So I'm always curious to hear about other people's shows.
Well, it was super interesting because my students hated Trello. They just
yeah.
hated it. They could not grasp the concept of Trello. So and it was just last week I talked to the person who had hired a couple of my students, and he said, it's so great that they know Trello because that's what we use. And I felt vindicated that I had forced them to learn this thing that I hated, and now it was at least serving some of them well.
Yeah, that's the internet. You know, innovations are bittersweet, right? And some things that you never thought were necessary, now you can't live without, or you never thought that they were needed, and then someone introduces you and you just think, oh my goodness, this is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And but then you have the dark side of the internet, which is, you know, sort of goes back to grammar, right? Do you think, as many do, that the internet is kind of destroying grammar, that all the rules that we learned in school about artful writing are sort of going out the window, sacrificed on the altar of speed?
No, I don't think that at all. I think that people write in different ways, in different media. I think that we get to see a lot more informal writing than we used to. You know, you don't see the note that someone jots to her husband and leaves on the refrigerator. You know, nobody else sees that. But now we all do. We see that because people are posting essentially those kind of messages to each other online. I think a linguist, John McWhorter, I believe it is, says that, you know, text messaging is essentially speech. Is the equivalent of speaking. So it's speaking that you do with your thumbs. So it tends to follow more the rules of speech than the rules of writing. I think it's important to give people an opportunity to practice the higher forms of writing, the essay writing and letter writing, you know, in writing a full blog post. I mean, I've certainly seen people, I see people write poorly all the time, but I don't think it's any worse because of the internet. I just think we see it more.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting.
Than we used to.
Yeah, and I think I'm getting to the age now where we can just be like, can you believe kids today? Like,
oh,
and,
me too. I always feel like, get off my lawn.
Yeah, oh, exactly. But one of my friends who I saw this weekend is a school teacher, and she was saying that kids will be totally shameless and write in papers you know, the letter U for the pronoun you, and things like that, that are, I guess you could call them text message kind of abbreviations. Now, those have been around for centuries. Everyone kind of realized, oh, the word U is similar to the letter U, and you see abbreviations all the time. But you would never actually hand it in to a teacher. Like, you knew that distinguishing line.
Right. And, you know, I may be lucky because my students are journalism students, so they tend to be good writers. But I was surprised with the quality of the midterms that I got, the midterm papers. They were really good. Their writing overall was great. Nobody was using text messaging abbreviations, you know, but again, you know, these are students who are focusing on writing. Andrea Lunsford, though, who at least a few years ago ran the Writing Center at Stanford, has done studies about the errors that in student writing over time, and she has found that there's not an increase in errors in student writing. There's a slight change in the kind of errors you see more. Misspellings, like homophones, like wrong word, like there and there, and
yes.
Affect and effect, like those kind of mistakes, the things that spell checker won't catch. But there isn't an overall increase in the number of errors in student papers, at least in her studies, over a long period of time. I think it's more than 50 years. So, you know, you can say kids today, but people have been saying kids today for hundreds of years.
Right, exactly. It's interesting now that we actually have data on this because of this modern age that you could look on Google and see the number of occurrences in published books for phrases like on accident, which are, you know, very contemporary because I think they pinpointed it actually say, oh, it's 1986. And after that, you probably say, but you know, by accident. And after that, you say on accident or something like that. Like, so it's interesting that there's a data side to it as well, that it's not just grammar anymore. Like, I'm thinking of the New York Times when they did that haiku thing.
Mm-hmm.
Go through the today's edition of the New York Times, and it knew how many syllables were in each words, and it would just contextually look for haikus in the stories, which I thought was just amazing. Like, that is a product of the internet age.
Right. I love the internet tools. I use Google's Ngram search all the time to look at, you know, phrases and when they first appeared in published books. And I like Google News Archive search too. You know, I've been able for the teddy bear, I was able to go back and see the stories about how Theodore Roosevelt inspired the teddy bear. And you could see the original cartoon in the newspaper. He went on a hunting trip and he refused to shoot this baby bear.
Sure.
And the cartoonist who was with him drew an adorable cartoon, and that sort of started the teddy bear craze. And you can go see the original cartoon in the Google News Archive. And, you know, that would have been really hard to do 10 years ago. You know, you'd have to go to a library or something. Now I can just sit at my desk and do it. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah, that's what they say. There's no more bar bets because you could just whip out your phone and look something up.
Right.
The internet is so funny. And some people say it's still, I say this actually as a designer, it's still mostly a written medium, which is why copywriting is so important. Long form writing, which is essentially journalism, you know, expos, whatever you want to call it, persuasive writing. But words, our grammar is very important. And I think that a lot of people don't see the link between design and language. So follow me on this. Here's my theory, right? That the link between language and design is basically this, that language requires certain grammars as structures. Grammar leads you right into punctuation, and punctuation leads you right into typography. And then typography, of course, is the cornerstone of good design, especially in graphic design, web design. And there you have it.
So, yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah, maybe you don't have fabrics yet, but that's the next step.
I brought our visual design professor in to talk to my social media students last semester because I think that creating good images lends credibility to your writing and your posts, and it's really important to get the fonts and the colors and the styles right.
Yeah, absolutely. And just as you want to be consistent with your usage of the Oxford comma, you have to be consistent whether, you know, your H2 is a 36-point type or whatever it is. It's kind of the same thing. And often designers will talk about the visual language and they'll create a brand that has a certain voice. So there's all sorts of personifications and, you know, embodiments and other type of metaphors.
Right. And if you do a Google search for style guide, you know, you'll come up with design style guides just as much as you'll come up with writing style guides. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we all have our style guides that help us be consistent.
Absolutely. Hey, everyone. Quick break before we get back into the show. I just want to remind everyone to go to busycreator.com/67, which is the show notes for this episode, number 67. We have a ton of links, everything that Grammar Girl is talking about. I've also got some videos embedded there. I put up something about her workflow, her book writing procedure, as well as a video from when she appeared on Triangulation on the Twit Network. So definitely check out the show notes. I got all the books, everything else. And actually, one of them is an audiobook only, so you can get that on audible.com if you go to busycreatorbook.com. Again, follow the link in the show notes. That's the easiest way. busycreator.com/67. Okay, let's get back. So I want to go back to academic work for just a second, just, I guess, to close that loop. Tell us a little bit about the type of courses you're teaching. And you mentioned undergrad and graduate courses.
Right. Well, they let me ease into it last year, which was great. So in the fall, I taught media entrepreneurship to graduate students in the School of Journalism. And sure. Then in the spring, I taught just one class. I taught social journalism, which is essentially social media. And I'm going to do the same thing again this year. And then I'm working on some special projects.
Okay. So are the grad students following you for a whole year and sort of working on a thesis together and that type of thing?
Yeah, I was on some thesis committees. I do not follow all of them for the whole year, but they're in my class, and I had them do media entrepreneurship projects. So they all came up with a business plan, and they ended the semester by giving their pitch for their business. And it's interesting to see, like, it's a required class, so they don't come in, you know, completely serious about starting a business. But, you know, I've kept in touch with some of them. And, you know, they are interested in starting their own businesses, maybe not the ones that they pursued for class. But, you know, one of them has the bug and yeah. wants to start a business. And another woman is, you know, she is from the local TV station, and now she's been working on a TV pilot. She was doing that before our class, but she said the class helped her, you know, figure out sort of the business side of it. So, you know, it's really interesting to see how they sort of absorb the concepts and then integrate them into what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can imagine that you'd be a great person to take your lead from, because you're one of the few people that's done this on that same scale, which is great. But, and also, I imagine that a lot of your students are writers, like writers. And so they're putting together books and everything. So, I mean, about that, you mentioned you had four books. How do you find the time to write the books in addition to doing the podcast, running the network?
Right.
Did you block off like a season of writing? You say, oh, yeah, this is my summer. I'm going to bang out the manuscript. Or did you work it into a daily regimen?
I worked it into a daily regimen. So actually, I wrote 7 books in 6 years.
Oh, my goodness.
It's been 2 or 3 years since I wrote a book, and I don't have plans to write any more for a while because there's just no time. You know, I started writing books right away. That was when I first hired help. So I brought in my first guest writer when I was writing my first book, because I just couldn't do it all.
Yeah.
I'm not great at setting a schedule and saying, I am going to write from 10 to 12 every day. Like, I'll say I'm going to do it, but I never do. What drives me is deadlines. I'm worthless without a deadline. Mm. So I'll look and see what I have done, and it's helpful for me to break it down into smaller segments and have, you know, my editor saying, okay, we need these 10 entries in a week, you know, as much as I really need someone to manage me. So for someone to create deadlines that I have to meet, that is about the only thing that helps me get anything done. And it's why the show gets out every week. I mean, if I didn't know that there were people waiting to listen to the show, I wouldn't do it.
That's interesting that sometimes the walls define the work. I mean, most creatives will say that the true blank page is like the scariest thing. But if you have a brief, or if you have a deadline, or if you have parameters, like even Twitter's creating parameters, it has to be 140 characters. There's so much creativity that's come out of that because of the parameters, you know, not in spite of them.
Right. I mean, I've been trying to write a novel for about 5 years, and I have not succeeded. I just can't do it because I don't have a deadline and there are no parameters. It can be whatever I want. And that's just like too much freedom for me. So I keep starting over and going in new directions and putting it off for months. And yeah, I think it'll never happen unless somehow I find a way to create parameters and set deadlines.
Okay. Well, check out some of our other shows. We have a couple about habits and other things. I've talked to some other writers recently, so
okay.
I can send you what I've learned from them. I haven't written a book yet myself, so I'm trying to learn as much as I can from people who actually have.
Yeah, I mean, I've written 7, but yeah. I can't do the other kind.
Because it's a novel, right? Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Are you doing sort of what I call applesaucing, which is like you have the apples, right? You sell the apples, and then some of them are kind of defective, so you chop them up, you make applesauce. So you're using your own content that you have published earlier, or maybe you've given some kind of a talk, and then you take that same content and repurpose it for a book chapter or for a segment like that, or even the sort of top 20 list, right? That you take your most popular blog posts, and then that could become a little pamphlet on its own, as long as you kind of synthesize it. Are you doing some of that?
Oh, there's an awful lot of that. I mean, there's probably nothing that I've done that hasn't been used two or three times. I don't find it inspiring myself. I don't like to just rehash what I've already done. I like to do the new, deeper, more interesting topics. But people really appreciate having the simple material in whatever format is convenient for them. So, you know, although like it might not be the most intellectually stimulating thing for me to take, you know, my top 20 tips and turn them into a webcast, but people who want that quick training find that really valuable. So we do that, and it's great. But I have to do the other things to keep myself interested.
No, that's something that I think you're seeing. Maybe you've always seen that in media, right? You've had top 40 radio on the weekends, which is kind of everything they played during the week. You have the greatest hits albums. You have kind of photographic retrospectives and the film festivals that are the best of Fellini or whatever it is. So you're always kind of seeing things again, presented in a different context or in an abbreviated form, and that's totally fine because now we all have different information diets. And for some of us, to read a 3,000 word article, you know, is not the way to go, but to see it 5 days later in a digest email, maybe that makes a lot more sense.
Right. It really makes a lot of sense to slice it and dice it all those different ways.
Yeah.
Applesauce.
Yeah. Great. So I want to sort of take it home a little bit for the last segment here. And I'm always curious to get inside the heads of the creatives here. Tell us about yours. Studio setup, and especially if you have a home studio and a work studio, like what's the difference between the two? Do you have a clean desk or do you use certain software, that type of thing?
Let's see, my desk is really messy. My home where I record is my walk-in closet. It's a pretty small walk-in closet, so I'm kind of cramped in there with my clothes, and I have the snowball on a mic stand that swings up, so it just swings up in the corner when I'm not recording, and then I swing it down when it's time to record. It's really small, it's really simple, but it works great. And then, you know, I have the fancy recording studio up at the university with the $1,000 mic and the big old mixer, but I only use one channel, so it's complete overkill. And, you know, I've had more technical difficulties with that fancy setup than I've ever had at home. So when I record up there, you know, maybe it sounds a tiny bit better, but it usually ends up taking me more time trying to get all the levels right, and maybe someone bumped the mic or changed some settings, so, 'cause it's shared.
Yeah.
When I got the job, I thought, oh, it's going to be awesome to record up here. And I find myself more and more going back home just because it's simpler.
Sure. But in desks in general, like, do you have the same laptop that you sort of take around? Or
I have a Mac desktop that I love with an enormous monitor. I think having the biggest monitor you can afford is the best efficiency tool. And then I have a Mac AirBook also that I use as a backup. I'm using that right now. You know, I take it with me when I travel, or I'll take it with me to school with my slides for lectures and things like that.
Sure.
I'm an Apple person through and through. I have like an iPhone and an iPod and an old iPhone. And I use two different iPhones for my personal and professional social media accounts. So I have like the dedicated Grammar Girl phone. And then I also have the Mignon Fogarty phone. It's just easier than logging in and out.
Oh yeah. I feel that pain.
Yeah. So I realized, oh, I've got this old iPod in a drawer I don't even use, like an iPod 5 or something. And I set it up with all my other accounts, and that works really well.
Yeah.
I really like Boomerang for Gmail. I used to use it more before I had an assistant, but when people send questions, you know, I want to get it out of my inbox right away. But if I answer someone within 30 seconds, then they think I'm available to chat.
Yeah, exactly.
So I need to delay sending those answers. And so I use Boomerang a lot to answer something now, but send it maybe tomorrow.
Sure. I've heard about that as well. I use a plugin for my desktop email client, which is similar. And it's great because, for example, when I publish a podcast episode, I'll email the person who joined me for that conversation and say, your episode is live. But obviously, if I send it early, it's not live yet. So,
right. Yeah, it's just handy to be able to send things later sometimes.
How about for collecting ideas and note-taking? Do you have a system for that?
Nope. I'm not all that ordered. You know, I'll favorite things on Twitter. I'll take screenshots of something from Facebook if someone asks an interesting question. I have an email folder called Questions. Uh-huh. And if I'm short of topic ideas, I'll go there and look. But I'm usually not. I usually have more than enough topic ideas for shows.
Okay.
It's embarrassingly not all that organized.
No, that's fine. And how about a personal routine or regimen? Do you have a wake-up time or an exercise regimen or coffee habit or something like that that kind of keeps you productive and creative?
Yeah, I work out every morning around 10 o'clock. So I'll get up, I'll have breakfast, I'll do email, you know, take care of some of the lighter activities of the day, and then I go work out before lunch, and that keeps me sane. Then, yeah, and I have to have caffeine with lunch. If for some reason I don't have iced tea or coffee with lunch, I'm like dead for the rest of the day. And then, yeah, so usually, you know, it's pretty light on the work until after lunch, and then I work pretty hard after lunch and through the evening.
Now, you mentioned a few shortcomings, a few of your weaknesses in terms of organization, which is fine. It's just great. That's kind of the point of the show, is that none of us can ever win at productivity. You can only make small increments and learn things and put them into play. But what is your team and you, like, what are you struggling with? Is there something you're trying to overcome next?
I think the thing we're struggling with most right now is trying to build up social media beyond Twitter and Facebook.
Right.
So, you know, we're focusing a lot on Pinterest, but that requires creating a different kind of image from what we usually create. And so that's, you know, putting something in our workflow that hasn't been there. I mean, it's not that hard, but it's just an additional thing to put in the workflow. And then also, I'm really interested in a new service called Clammr, C-L-A-M-M-R, which lets you upload 18-second audio clips, and then they're quite shareable. You can post them on Twitter or Facebook, and then people can share them. So it's a way to try to make audio shareable. But again, putting that, you know, creating the 18-second clip, whether that's editing it in Audacity or selecting it on the phone, is another addition to the workflow. And so that doesn't always get done every week. And then I feel bad when it doesn't get done. So
yeah, absolutely. I know where you're coming from, because every 5 minutes there's a new platform. There's some cool new tool. And to be cynical about it, it's kind of like, all right, well, now I got to get this thing out to the world. I have to keep marketing it, keep promoting it. But at the same time, if people are interested in that topic and they're hanging out somewhere that you've never been, you could potentially be missing out to make those connections. But it is absolutely exhausting. I know where you're coming from, especially as a solo practitioner, or for example, if you have each of the people on your site who are looking after their own network. It is absolutely exhausting, and I think that this is the challenge facing all of us, is that we want to know if we have 1 hour a day to do promotions on social media or on the internet in general, which I guess includes email and your own site, like, how should we best spend that time to make real connection, not just add noise, right, to contribute more junk, but to actually have a meaningful interaction with the community in that particular site. So, I feel that struggle.
And the thing is, I like to do experiments with a lot of different things, and I like to do those myself to see if they're working. You know, if something really catches on, then I can hand it over to my assistant to like continue. But for the initial, like, is this even worth doing? I like to do it myself. But there are so many things that you can test to see if they're worth doing now. But that's probably the biggest challenge.
Awesome. All right. Well, the final question, of course, how can folks see more of your work, listen to your podcast, check out the other stuff on the network, take your class maybe? How can we get in touch?
Sure. So you search for Grammar Girl almost anywhere you'll find me. So Twitter and Facebook, I'm Grammar Girl. You Google search for Grammar Girl, you get my articles. If you search Who Versus Whom, Grammar Girl, mine will come up. My main website is quickanddirtytips.com. That's the whole network. And you'll find all the other great Quick and Dirty Tips podcasters there too. Money Girl and the Get It Done Guy and Get Fit Guy, Nutrition Diva. Like, there's a whole network of shows. And you can search for those too at iTunes or Stitcher for Grammar Girl or Quick and Dirty Tips. And then, yeah, if you want to come to the University of Nevada in Reno and take one of my classes in the School of Journalism, we'd love to have you.
Great. I don't know who's out there hanging out, but I would totally take your class if I was nearby. Are you doing any kind of tours, any speaking or workshops or anything?
I did a lot of speaking last year, and I'm trying to cut back.
Okay.
Actually, it was just too much. So.
All right, kick those over to me. I'll talk about hyphens for half an hour.
Okay, sounds good.
I have one in my name. And this, actually, I was just listening today as we were recording. I was listening to you talking about prefixes and suffixes, collectively known as affixes. And I used to joke because my name, Prescott Perez Fox, has a prefix and a suffox.
Oh, that's great. And a hyphen.
Which is ridiculous. Like, anyone with punctuation in their name has a whole other level of drama, especially when it comes to the post office.
Oh, yeah. At least you don't have an apostrophe.
No. I know some people with spaces, with apostrophes. Yeah, it's a mess.
Yeah. And I sympathize.
Well, thank you so much, Mignon.
You're welcome. Thank you, Prescott. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, me too. That'd be great.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Okay.
Okay, that was Grammar Girl. Yeah. Now, after hearing the ins and outs of her company, I'm in total awe of her, and I think we should all be mindful of her practices and how she expanded and built a model that could be replicated with the Quick and Dirty Tips podcast and the whole network. So if you're like me, working, doing your thing, keep those eyes open for opportunities, how you can build something expandable, and maybe how you can team up and who you can team up with. Also, watch out for dangling modifiers. Those are a tricky one. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, I've got links to everything we discussed over at busycreator.com/67. That's the show notes for this episode. That's where you can leave us a comment, get in touch with Mignon, get her books, and check out those videos, and learn about everything that the Busy Creator has to offer. Next time on the podcast, I speak to Dan Fields on the topic of sales in the creative industries.
I think for anybody who's in charge of managing or producing people, you got to know what you're talking about. Read a book about coding, learn Photoshop. I mean, you got to be able to do that kind of stuff.
And that episode will be released in 2 weeks. Make sure you subscribe in iTunes or on your phone's podcast app so you don't miss future episodes. Theme song for The Busy Creator is an original composition by Joaquin Kotler. Check him out at joaquinkotler.com. The Busy Creator is a project from Starship Design, graphic design and branding for small business and startups. Visit us online at starshipdesign.us. I'm Prescott Perez Fox, and thank you for listening to The Busy Creator podcast. This show grows better with your support. The best way to help is to share with a friend or colleague. Send them to busycreator.com or connect with us on social media. Until next time, get busy and create.